defense than lethal.
Until not long ago, only civilians living near the front line got wounded or killed. Now, following the new medium and long-range weapons provided by NATO to Ukraine, we have a much higher number of civilians being hospitalized. Look behind my back. Our hospital was targeted a few weeks ago.
Ukrainian armed formations have shelled hospitals a number of times over the past months. This hospital in central Donetsk, Voroshilovsky district, was hit by the artillery on April 28. That shelling caused 9 civilian casualties and severe damage to the building. On that occasion, among the dead civilians, 16 people also suffered injuries from the blast. Kyiv's forces fired high-explosive fragmentation missiles produced in Slovakia and transferred to Ukraine by NATO countries.
We have been denouncing this situation since 2015. We started with the European Court of Human Rights, but for inexplicable reasons, our case was dismissed. We tried then with the International Criminal Court, but they have never visited the Donbas, and this case was subsequently dismissed. We are now trying to bring it forward to the UN. Will human rights be finally protected here as well?
In fear of attacks on residential areas, kids have been forced to switch to remote learning throughout the whole school year, which, by the way, ends on Tuesday. Max Civili, Donetsk.
To commemorate the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Hezbollah conducted an unprecedented live military drill in the South Lebanese town of Aramta. After a show of hand-to-hand combat and a parade of all-terrain vehicles and motorcycles, the fighters launched a simulation of taking over an Israeli post in the occupied Galilee area. Over 100 media outlets covered the event, which many say is something unseen since before the liberation in 2000.
The location chosen for this is quite telling. First of all, it's close to the border with Israel. And of course, this area back in before 2000 was under Israeli occupation. The old Bir Kalab outpost the Israelis had was just up on the hill behind us. So this is very familiar territory for Hezbollah.
The head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayed Hashem Safieddine, warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his cabinet will not be able to change the rules of engagement.
Our message to Israel is clear. If you think that you can launch a full-scale aggression in order to strike the equations of deterrence, which we made with our blood and armaments and strength, we will be ready to shower you with precise rockets, and you will witness black days unlike any other. The Israeli regime knows what we mean. We will use our precise rockets and all means available to us.
Observers see that Hezbollah is primarily seeking psychological warfare against Israel with this maneuver.
But clearly the message is towards the Israelis primarily. As we've seen with the recent escalation in Gaza, we've seen a tightening of the ties, the military ties between Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So I think this show today feeds into that.
Hezbollah says the drill sent a message to the Israeli regime about the readiness of the resistance to deter enemy aggression and defend Lebanon. Israeli forces left most of southern Lebanon on May 25, 2000, after 22 years of occupation. Hezbollah's military drill is not merely a show of force with prospects of a possible confrontation and continuous Israeli aggressions towards Al-Quds. Hezbollah wants to send a clear message to the Israelis that its deterrence capabilities remain intact. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasem, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to a school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these potatoes under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone.
While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement has organized a celebration event in Damascus countryside, marking its victory against Israel in the recent battle in the Gaza Strip. In a televised speech, Secretary General of the movement, Ziad Nakhale, announced the victory against the Israeli regime, expressing pride in the people of Gaza, who he said manufactured their own weapons with the help of member countries of the resistance front.
We succeeded in the battle and we preserved Palestinians' unity. We proved to the enemy our continuous readiness to engage in battle after another in defense of our people. Any assassination operation will be met with a strong, clear and painful response in which Tel Aviv or other Israeli cities will be in the range of our rockets.
The event was attended by representatives of Syria-based Palestinian factions. Speakers said Palestinians and resistance groups showed unprecedented unity through the Joint Operations Room while retaliating against Israel. They rejected any concessions with Israel and refused to acknowledge any political settlement with the enemy.
We underline the importance of national unity and armed resistance, which is the only option we have. We reject concessions, Oslo Accords, or any security coordination or recognition of Israel. We call for boycotting Israel politically and economically and punishing the enemy for the crimes against Palestinians.
Videos were played on a large screen showing the retaliatory battle codenamed Revenge of the Free, including images of the Islamic Jihad leaders who were assassinated or lost their lives while confronting Israeli attacks. Resistance movements like the Islamic Jihad believe that resistance is not an option, but in fact a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime. And for long, it has been the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there were hundreds of refugees, mainly from African and Middle Eastern countries, sleeping on the streets outside the main asylum application centre in Brussels. Authorities have since cleared the area. The refugees have fled to neighbouring countries or have been crammed into emergency accommodation. A few remain in the area, but say their situation would be different if they came from Ukraine.
Only because we are Afghan, because we come from Syria, because we don't have the same color, because we don't have same culture, but it will be not the reason. Of course, a lot of people, we have the same mind. I can work, I can do everything.
When you come here from Ukraine, you get everything. Accommodation, food, work, everything. If you are from somewhere else, as a refugee, you do not get anything.
If you look, I cut also myself, because we don't feel good in camp.
Sometimes you want to die?
Yes, I want to die. You look at my hands, I cut it my hands too much with blades. I do it too much. Because what is it, life, eat and going to sleep?
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that EU nations are erecting borders on land and strengthening aggressive coast guard services at sea. The bloc pays billions of euro to outside countries to stop refugees from attempting to travel here, unless they are from Ukraine.
The EU slogan is, break the business model of smugglers. But what we do is feeding them. By blocking all pathways to protection.
There is a heavy far-right anti-refugee presence in the Parliament.
Europe needs a policy based on strong border control.
But many legislators are calling for a more civilized approach.
We already fund third countries like Libya, actually militias over there, to build camps, to host people there. And we see murder, we see rape, and we do not see a humane solution.
Key EU figures are currently in Hiroshima, Japan, for a G7 meeting. 350,000 people were living there when their closest ally, the United States, dropped its catastrophic atomic bomb in 1945. More support for Ukraine is high on the agenda. Critics say the last thing on their minds is providing refuge to those fleeing countries they helped destabilize in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since massive regular protests began in January, the French government has held discussions with union leaders regarding a 2-year hike to the retirement age. A notable problem with that long delay is that the age hike has already been forced into law via a decree by President Emmanuel Macron. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against the change, but the government is standing firm, even though anger is rising to threatening levels nationwide. The First Lady's nephew was recently beaten by protesters over the age hike. Over 60% of the country wants the Prime Minister fired, and neither Macron nor his ministers can appear in public without protesters noisily banging casserole pans.
There's enormous anger right now. Macron has destroyed our social services, given huge tax gifts to the rich, persecuted injustices while allowing the far right to demonstrate without barely any police presence, and this is not even a complete list. People just want to live normally, but the Macron era is one of sadness and poverty.
Unions say the country will not get back to normal unless the age hike is revoked, but France has seen massive anti-government unrest regularly for well over a decade, and usually over far-right austerity measures. France and the European Union continue to be hounded by accusations that they are anti-democratic, and the latest of many French presidential decrees has only further increased dissatisfaction and dissent.
There is growing realization that our major national policies are decided in Brussels, and that our president is a mere puppet. We're also subservient to Washington. Simply look at what we're doing in Ukraine for more proof. So there's no hope that we'll have democracy during the last 4 years of Macron's term. But if we don't get it in 2027, things will explode.
Union leaders left the closed-door meeting, calling it not useful and a one-way monologue. The pension age hike has overshadowed other crises, such as record inflation, the arming of the unrest in Ukraine, and stagnant wages. But all of those remain unresolved flashpoints as well. Barring a surprise reversal from the government, unions are planning a 14th day of nationwide strikes next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hundreds of Orthodox Jews protested outside the UK Parliament building on Tuesday over fears the establishment will begin regulating traditional Jewish faith schools known as yeshivot. Protest leaders made clear they considered any legislation targeting unregulated Jewish religious institutions as anti-Semitic, and they may be forced to flee Britain to protect their religious freedoms from unwelcome reforms.
Today, we face a concerning challenge as politicians attempt to push through a proposed register for children educated outside of school. This is no ordinary bill, but one that seeks to sneak in new laws through the back door under the guise of a private member's bill. This registered proposal targets our strictly Orthodox Jewish community, intending to undermine our way of life more than any other group. It reeks of state-sponsored anti-Semitism.
What concerns these religious Jewish parents is regulated British education mandates lessons on lifestyles which contradict Jewish religious beliefs, including relationship and sex education, or RSE, LGBT propaganda, and other anti-religious ideologies, including atheism.
Well, we're not talking about murdering anybody. We're just talking about what we don't want our children to be taught. And we're just following what it says in our religion. And it's absolutely disgraceful that you're not allowed to do that in this country. And that's anti-Semitic.
These protests come after years of public anger expressed by parents, particularly British Muslims, over RSE lessons already being implemented in state schools. Opt-out options are not available, and accusations of indoctrination or anti-religious propaganda being fed to young children has been rife. In January 2023, a petition went viral, gaining over 200,000 signatures, demanding the government remove LGBT teaching from the controversial curriculum. The government responded, saying,
"The statutory guidance states that all pupils should receive teaching on LGBT content during their school years. Secondary schools should include LGBT content in their teaching. Primary schools are strongly encouraged and enabled when teaching about different types of family to include families with same-sex parents."
The ruling Conservative government has routinely attacked left-wing opposition over their support for the Palestinian cause and their criticism of Britain's relationship with the Israeli regime. However, and quite ironically, it's now number 10 that finds itself on the receiving end of not only accusations of anti-Semitism, but also Islamophobia and for being anti-religion in general, over an education system which is perceived to be discriminating against religious minority rights. Robert Carter, London.
In the limelight. According to an opinion poll released recently, concerns over gun violence epidemic and the prospect of losing their homes have increasingly weighed on young Americans. U.S. Democrats and gun safety activists have argued that passing stricter laws would reduce gun violence in the United States, whereas Republicans and gun rights advocates are saying that arming people would act as a deterrent. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has covered this story and tells us more. A new study has revealed that about half of young Americans feel unsafe amid concerns over gun violence and homelessness, with a quarter of them having thoughts that they would be better off dead. An opinion poll conducted by the Institute of Politics at Harvard Kennedy School showed that 48% of Americans aged between 18 and 29 have felt unsafe in the past month, with 40% worried about falling victim to gun violence and 32% concerned that they could become homeless one day. In the spring of 2023 edition of the Harvard Youth Poll, which was conducted between 13th and 22nd of March, 2,069 people between the ages of 18 and 29 were surveyed. The 45th edition of the poll also indicated that over 3 in 5, or 63%, of young Americans support stricter gun laws. According to a non-profit research group, more than 12,800 people in the United States have died from gun violence so far this year, which means an average of over 114 deaths per day. The latest report by Gun Violence Archive says there have been 168 mass shooting incidents so far this year, and that the number of mass shootings has gone up significantly in recent years. According to the poll, U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating dropped from 39% last fall to 36% due to the worsening figures associated with violence across America. The survey also found that 47% of Americans under the age of 30 report feeling down, depressed, or hopeless, and 24% have had thoughts that they would be better off dead or have considered self-harm at least several days in the last 2 weeks. Seti Warren, director of the Institute of Politics, IOP, said the data collected in this opinion poll clearly demonstrates not only the growing level of political engagement among young people, but the urgency of addressing serious issues such as mental health, gun violence, housing, and more. Ethan Jasny, a 25-year-old student chair of the Harvard Public Opinion Project, said, "From fears of mass shootings to concerns of one day becoming homeless, the current state of Generation Z could perhaps best be summarized in one word, anxious." Generation Z refers to a generation that was born between 1997 and 2012. Ethan Jasny said, "Young Americans have translated this fear into action, turning out to vote like their rights and lives depend on it. But we cannot take this engagement for granted. Public figures across the political divide must recognize the profound personal challenges that members of my generation face every day." The Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. The U.S. is setting a record pace for mass killings in 2023, replaying the horror on a loop roughly once a week so far this year. The carnage has taken 88 lives in 17 mass killings over 111 days. Each time, the killers wielded firearms. Only 2009 was marked by as many such tragedies in the same period of time. Children at a Nashville, Tennessee grade school gunned down on an ordinary day recently. Farm workers in Northern California sprayed with bullets over a workplace grudge. Attendees at a venue outside Los Angeles, California massacred as they celebrated the Lunar New Year. Recently, 4 partygoers were slain and 32 injured in Dadeville, Alabama, when bullets rained down on a Sweet 16 celebration. And a man just released from prison fatally shot 4 people, including his parents, in Bordeaux, Maine, before opening fire on motorists traveling on a busy interstate highway. The bloodshed represents just a fraction of the fatal violence that occurs in the United States annually. According to an analysis of the Associated Press USA Today data, yet mass killings are happening with staggering frequency this year, an average of once every 6.5 days. The 2023 numbers stand out even more when they are compared to the tally for full year totals since data was collected. The U.S. recorded 30 or fewer mass killings in more than half of the years in the database. So to be at 17, less than a third of the way through, is remarkable. From coast to coast, the violence is sparked by a range of motives. Murders, suicides, and domestic violence, gang retaliation, school shootings, and workplace vendettas all have taken the lives of 4 or more people at once since 1st of January this year. Yet the violence continues and barriers to change remain. The likelihood of Congress reinstating a ban on semi-automatic rifles appears far off, and the U.S. Supreme Court last year set new standards for reviewing the nation's gun laws, calling into question firearms restrictions across the country. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this story. Academic studies have shown that one-fifth of American households bought guns during the coronavirus pandemic, according to an analysis by the Trace, a non-profit, non-partisan news organization that tracks gun violence in the United States. U.S. citizens purchased nearly 60 million guns between 2020 and 2022. All the new weapons have fueled a momentous surge in gun deaths, which reached record highs during the same period. Demand for firearms had been growing throughout the coronavirus outbreak. California, New York, Washington, Alabama, and Ohio were a few states, among others, that were reporting firearm sales growth. Gun control advocates were concerned that due to the coronavirus pandemic, many new gun owners were lacking the usual access to training on how to handle and store their weapons. The COVID-19 pandemic triggered a run on gun shops, as many Americans thought society might collapse. Nick Suplina, Senior Vice President of Law and Policy at Everytown for Gun Safety, a gun control nonprofit organization, said, "There were fear and real concern about what happens to the country during a global pandemic." The activist said the pro-gun lobby, National Rifle Association, NRA, fanned that fear by tweeting out a video of a woman holding a rifle and pushing firearms as a pandemic safety measure. The woman says, "You might be stockpiling up on food right now to get through this current crisis. But if you aren't preparing to defend your property when everything goes wrong, you're really just stockpiling for somebody else." According to an NORC survey, some 18% of households bought guns between March of 2020 and March of 2022. Some states have tried to impose more gun control within their own borders. Recently, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed a new law mandating criminal background checks to purchase rifles and shotguns, whereas the state previously required them only for people buying pistols. And recently, a ban on dozens of types of semi-automatic rifles cleared the Washington state legislature and is headed to the governor's desk. Other states are experiencing a new round of pressure. In conservative Tennessee, protesters descended on the state capitol to demand more gun regulation after six people were killed at a Nashville private elementary school last month.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, just over 1 week remains to June, the first deadline for the U.S. government to raise the debt ceiling, which is currently at $31.38 trillion. If the debt ceiling is not increased, the government will not be able to continue paying its bills. The debt ceiling debate has become synonymous with wrangling between Democrats and Republicans and seeing which concessions can be received. Republicans want to use the crisis to get the Democrats to cut back on spending. Democrats say it's not the right time for that as the country is facing a crisis. In the middle of all this, it's the people who are on edge and wondering what is really going on. Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Help me look at all of this. Out of Atlanta, Paul Craig Roberts, Chairman of the Institute for Political Economy and former Assistant Secretary of U.S. Treasury. And out of Washington, Marcia Baker, economic expert, EIR, I believe. Thank you both for being with me. Good to see you. Paul, what is going on? Let's talk about this debt ceiling. Let's simplify it. I mean, for those of us with not strong economic background, what is going on here?
Typically, the two parties jockey over what spending can be cut. The Republicans have their favorite slate of spending cuts, and the Democrats have their own. And normally, it goes right down to the wire, and some agreement is made. It's never failed in the past, even though the media pays a huge amount of attention to it. It is possible that something else could be going on this time. I've noticed over recent years a tendency on the part of some Western governments for the executive to bypass the legislature. We saw that recently in France, where the French president simply removed the issue of raising the pension age from the legislature and raised it by edict. Mm-hmm. We've seen similar edicts on the part of George W. Bush and Obama in suspending civil liberties. And this is sort of a growing trend that's gradually accumulating power in the executive. Now, if an agreement is not reached, and if Biden refuses any sort of accommodation with the Republicans, it would be on purpose that an agreement is not reached. But Biden can simply then declare a national emergency and raise the limit by himself. There's really nothing to stop him from doing that. And it could well be that this is part of some program of further eroding powers of legislatures in the Western countries and further putting them into the hands of the executive.
Interesting. Well, Marcia, what does it mean when the U.S. government debt of $31.38 trillion is about 22% more than the value of all goods and services that will be produced in the U.S. economy this year?
Well, first, let me just endorse what the speaker just said about the, so to speak, politics, if we're moving to edicts, government by edicts. Mm. But in your question, what does it mean? It would be very bad to have a shock of interruption to functioning of debt offerings, public debt. But let me not go into scenarios, but instead say that this kind of impasse we're seeing of discussions of whether to agree on a debt ceiling level represents a generalized incompetence in the leadership layer, because our dollar system and our domestic economy, and we can talk internationally as well, is really in breakdown. You know that the degree of lending is shrinking for in the general commercial economy, for housing, for businesses, for small businesses. You've seen four banks, regional banks, fail. Mm-hmm. There has been a removal of deposits in our banking system in the United States of $1 trillion within the last year. And this kind of withdrawal of funds is going on, $12 billion first quarter this year. So there are interruptions and breakdown. And whether Republican or Democrat, this is not being faced with a few exceptions. Speaking of Congress, where the action is, and there's some talk with President Biden, as you know, there are moves to look more seriously at the economy. Do you know there's a reintroduction of the what's called the Glass-Steagall Law from the 1930s that operated for 60 years that would help re-regulate banks so you could have credit to restore production? But so far, it's rear guard.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. They're talking about restoring that after so much theft has taken place and so many businesses, unfortunately, have gone down. Well, Paul, I mean, U.S. President Joe Biden says America is not a deadbeat nation. We pay our bills. How true is this reality? I mean, because the U.S. gets away with a lot because, of course, the dollar so far is still the global currency, although definitely diminishing fast. I mean, tell me what that has meant for the United States to be able to do what it does.
Being the world currency means that everyone else pays your bills. Mm-hmm. You see, if you are the world currency and your currency is used to settle international transactions by the rest of the world, there's a huge demand for your dollars, for your currency. In this case, the U.S. dollar. And this demand for dollars absorbs all of the debt that results from the United States trade deficit and the United States budget deficit, because the foreign central banks are willing to hold their surplus dollars in the form of U.S. Treasury bonds. So being the world reserve currency, it means you don't have to pay your bills, or that you pay them by printing money, because the rest of the world uses your currency to settle its international transactions, and therefore the world's central banks hold the dollars in the form of U.S. Treasury debt. And so financing the American debt has never been a problem since the dollar became the world reserve currency after World War II. And this is often overlooked by the debates in the Congress about debt and so on. When the debt becomes a problem is, as you noted, when the dollar loses its reserve currency role, which recent American policies are causing to happen, such as the Russian sanctions, the Iranian sanctions, the seizure of the Russian central bank reserves. These are convincing other countries that it's risky to hold on to dollars because you can be sanctioned that way. And so we see increasingly countries settling their international transactions in currencies other than the dollar. And this is what is the threat, not so much the American debt, but the fact that it's losing the ability to have the rest of the world finance its debt, because it's driving people away from the use of the dollar as world reserve currency.
Well, what about that, Marcia? I mean, in so many ways, it seems like the United States is just shooting itself in the foot. On the other hand, they're making a big deal about the debt ceiling crisis that, as Paul said, at the end of the day, they're going to increase the, they will increase it as they always have. On the other hand, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of attention to the fact of that the dollar is falling fast and the effect that that will have overall on the United States and American lifestyles.
You're quite right. Things are moving steadily along. There are central banks in the world getting out of the dollar and buying quite a bit of gold. It's not as if it's dramatic or overnight. But this process where we see China, India, and Russia discussing a potential new system for exchange of currencies for trade to replace the SWIFT system of the West, all of these things are moving along. And there is a blank out as well as a blackout in some of the current office holders of the United States on this, but it's definitely happening. Plus, I could add the war economy effect, that syndrome, where, for example, in all the wrangling over the debt ceiling in Congress and with the White House, there has been agreement not to touch the $870 billion U.S. Fiscal year 2023 military budget. So if you put war expenditures in the transatlantic, in Europe as well as here in the U.S., on top of the decreasing activity in the real economy, industry, agriculture, infrastructure, this is a very grim picture. It could be reversed, but it's headed towards worse and a real crisis.
Well, Marcia talked about the war economy. I want to talk about that a little bit, Paul, because on the one hand, the government says it may run out of money, but on the other hand, there's always money for war and the war machine. And even in the middle of this so-called crisis, we see the billions are steadily going to the war effort in Ukraine. I mean, what does it all mean, Paul?
Well, the President Dwight Eisenhower warned the country in 1961 in his last public address as a two-term president about the military security complex. He said that we had not disarmed after World War II because of the Cold War, and we had watched the military industrial complex, is what he called it at the time. We still had industry in those days, was gaining so much power that it might become a threat to democracy. And of course, they have. They have enormous campaign contribution funds. If you go against their budget, you will be cut off from funding. Your opponent will get the funding. It's a very dangerous and risky thing for any member of the House or Senate to cut the military budget. And even the Democrats who claim they want to do it, they won't really do it. It's their response to the Republicans who always want to cut the social spending. So I think that on the whole, the situation is sort of understandable. And the only real ingredient I already mentioned, it may well be that this is a opportunity that the executive branch will use for Biden to give an order that the debt ceiling is raised. That would be the most unique feature about the current controversy.
Okay, well, Marcia, I mean, there are those critics who say this whole crisis situation dealing with the debt ceiling is manufactured in the way the attention is brought to it, and basically trying to reflect or deflect from something else, other things that are happening in the society, or perhaps, as we've already talked about, the fall of the dollar or the fall in general of the power of the hegemon. I mean, what's your perspective on that side of things?
Well, I agree with you. You put your finger on it the way there are manufactured issues in the U.S. media. My fellow panelist was talking about the military-industrial complex, and really you have a military-industrial academic media complex, and keep going. They are saying, whereas for many Americans, they are seeing in their localities and their states very drastic social and economic breakdown examples. 63 rural hospitals are on the brink of shutting down right now around especially the farm states. You have the suicide rate among youth and by the way, among farmers, I just mentioned farmers, you have more homelessness, suburban housing crisis. You have the end of the public health special program for COVID-19 that was announced a week ago by the federal government. So no more special kind of help for food aid, housing aid, hospital aid. And this is all going on when your television is telling you, you must follow like a sports event, what's going to happen with the debt ceiling. So there's a disconnect there. It's going to get more and more. And I think some of the demonstrations, as your program just mentioned, the Belgian workers are in the streets. You've had farmers demonstrate in Europe. And here in the US, the growing dissatisfaction with the rubber stamp, very dangerous, continued military support for Ukraine is not just an economic issue. It's becoming repugnant. And so that's the real background that's taking place behind the apparent issue of the debt ceiling debate.
Mm. Well, Paul, I mean, in the middle of this that we've talked about as far as reactions from the Republicans or the Democrats, and basically they're going to go after their interests and make sure they stay in office. In the middle of this, the American people who are suffering, really suffering, now, as Marcia's just pointed out, various issues as far as pointing towards deterioration of overall lifestyle. What is it going to take? She also mentioned about demonstrations in Belgium and other countries. But in general, the American populace may hear and may say they understand what is going on. But at the end of the day, it seems that little is done as far as pushback against these government policies.
Well, what you see, when I was a young man, the United States had a homogeneous population. But there was change in 1965 to immigration laws, and we have now become a multicultural situation in which identity politics is used to separate the various components of the population and turn them against one another. So we have all the black antagonisms against whites that are increasingly expressed in stronger and stronger words. We have the sexually perverse people who are making new claims and demands for recognition and criticisms of the more normal heterosexual people, so that there's really no social unity. So there's no united people. What the United States is today is a Tower of Babel. The greatest problem that we face remains unrecognized. Again, when I was a young man, the United States was self-sufficient economically. It was short only in energy. Well, a self-sufficient economy doesn't have to worry about trade deficits.
Hmm.
But what offshoring of American production has done from globalism, the offshoring of U.S. manufacturing to China and Asia, has made the United States import dependent, because when the offshored production of American firms are brought back to the United States to be marketed, they enter as imports. And so by offshoring our production, we guarantee that we would have forever a very large trade deficit. And so we've already touched on this situation. When the dollar ceases to be the reserve currency, there's no way to finance this trade deficit. And so what happens at that point, the U.S. dollar simply collapses in value. Well, the worst inflations in history are caused by currency collapse. So if the dollar collapses in value, being import dependent, as the United States is, there'll be a massive rise in prices and a huge decline in real incomes. Well, if we already are afflicted with homelessness and poverty and so on, which we are, those situations will become worse. So the attention of the United States government should be on how to bring the jobs that are offshored back so that we don't create a needless, an unnecessary trade deficit that sooner or later is not going to be able to be financed. So that is the real overriding problem, because if we see a collapse in the value of the dollar when we are import dependent, it means a tremendous hit to American living standards, which have been taking small hits all along the way now for some 20 years. So that's the real challenge to Washington, and you can't get anyone to acknowledge it or to mention it, because globalism has become sort of like an ideology. People are committed to it. They think it's absolutely necessary, and so on and so on, and they've been given all sorts of false promises about it. But it's actually extremely deadly.
Right. Well, let me get Marcia in. So sorry, Paul. Let me just get Marcia in this last minute or so. Marcia, you heard what Paul just said. I mean, what we have seen in the United States when he was talking about, for example, in the 60s, and of course, a very large middle class. And now we've seen that shift, that financial shift to that 1%, that 1% or that 10% at the top, getting richer and richer as the bottom 99%, the bottom 90% actually are under more pressure. But at the same time, if politicians, those who are running the country, are not willing to actually do what they need to do to improve for the average American, to improve the situation, I mean, your prognosis of where you see the United States heading to?
It's a tall order, but it's possible to make a shift. And we have no choice. Those of us, and there's people everywhere in every country that can do what's individually necessary, can make the difference, because the flip side of de-dollarization is we need a new world financial and economic framework in which we re-rev up production in a place like the United States. We still can re-regulate banks and issue credit for projects, water management out west, all that kind of thing, and respect other nations and work with them. Now, we have to counter the blackout in the United States of where this kind of development is going on. Look at China and